Hello and welcome to the next in the series, The Leadership Hikers. My name is Amar Ghani and I'm a retired GP from Sheffield. Together with my friend and colleague, Dr. Joanna Bircher, a GP from Greater Manchester, we're talking with people mainly from primary care who've inspired us with their stories about what they care about and how they've helped to make life better for their communities. Joanna and I have written about what it takes to lead well in our book, The Leadership Hike. And this series, well, it's all about the people who do this, the people who we call the leadership hikers. It's about them, what they've learned, and through them, what we might learn too. So I'm really delighted to welcome the next of our hikers, Dr. Ollie Hart, who's a GP from Sheffield. He's a clinical director of Healy Plus Primary Care Network. And amongst many other things, he's also co-founder and director of Peak Health Coaching. So, Ollie, hi, welcome.
Oh, hi, Amar. It's always such a pleasure to talk and think with you.
Well, that's very kind. We have the pleasure of being friends as well as colleagues, which is fantastic. So, Ollie, I know from talking to many people who, like us, like you, care about stuff in the community and find themselves in positions of leadership, I can't remember one who said to me that I actually wanted to be a leader. It's something they find themselves doing. I just wondered, you know, does that resonate with you? And if it does, what was it for you that awakened that sense of, you know, I really care about this?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, it can sound a bit grandiose, can't it, being a leader? And you think of Winston Churchill type people standing out front. But my experience has been quite different to that, really. And often you find, don't you, people are quite reluctant leaders, really. But I think they realize that they have a burning desire to get something done, something they really believe in, a sense of purpose. And that kind of almost forces you into a leadership position because you want to be part of driving something you really believe in.
I know from an early experience in your life that you were working in pain clinic and that had quite a profound effect on you, working with people with chronic pain, I should say. Could you tell us a little bit about that and how it shaped, you know, what you felt you wanted to do?
I have been very interested in the role of health coaching, which is essentially about helping to kind of create the conditions, the environment for people to look after themselves really well, if you like, to take the lead themselves. The pain clinic was where I think I first came across this. You know, you tend to sort of discover things in life, don't you, rather than, you know, specifically setting out to learn something. And I was working with a colleague and a friend of mine called Dr. Tim Williams, and we were both GPs with a special interest in chronic pain. And what we learned in the pain clinic was that despite all the kind of facilities at our hands, you know, medication, injections, operations, what really worked well in the pain clinic was the support that enabled people to take more of a control for themselves and to kind of, you know, take more of a lead in what they were doing. And we became really interested in how you do that as a professional, how you become expert at creating those conditions. And it was that process that led us into thinking about health coaching. And it led Tim and I to think, well, this is really good stuff. It works in pain. We realized it worked across all the long-term conditions that we deal with regularly in general practice. So we thought, well, we've just got to take this forward. So that's why we set up Peak Health Coaching. And I think it's why I've positioned myself in a primary care network and as a GP in places where I just really focus on trying to help people to take as much of a lead as they can. You know, that sort of even power dynamic, where as a professional, you're working as a partner rather than a sort of telling someone what to do leader. You're working as a partner and you're helping someone to attain the best possible level they can for themselves.
You've used the word coaching a few times, which is great because I think this is an area that would be fascinating to explore. Maybe for those of us who are not so familiar with the concept of coaching and what it actually means, it's a word that gets bandied about a lot. Could you give us a little bit more detail on what coaching means to you? And maybe as we're thinking about that, maybe some thoughts on what coaching actually isn't.
When we're talking about this, we often talk about the metaphor of a sports team. You know, let's take a professional football club. You know, they are really bothered with how their team performs, how their players perform. You know, there's huge money at stake, isn't there? You know, but in a huge partisan support for it. So you can imagine that a professional football team would utilize all they can to help their players to perform well. I think everyone would agree, you never find a professional football team that didn't have coaches, you know, that are purposefully focused on trying to get the best out of their players. Now, the coaches don't play the game. Come Saturday afternoon, the players are on the pitch doing the things for themselves. But in the background, the coaches are building confidence. They're helping them to connect with techniques. They're helping them to practice things. And they're helping them to tune into what's really going to work well. And so I think, you know, health coaching is similar. What we've realized is that people living with long-term conditions or even trying to prevent them, you know, have to take a role themselves. So if you want them to perform really well in that function of looking after themselves, it makes sense to have health coaches. Now, if you take that metaphor further, just in the same with the football club, sometimes players get injured, you know, and they have treatment, you know, they have physiotherapists, they have operations, they have things to treat them when they're unwell. Which is different to coaching. You know, coaches tend to work with players when they're, you know, when they're performing and so on. And it's the same with health coaching. So, you know, there are times when people are ill and sick and they need therapy to bring them back to a level where they're kind of more stable again. And that's then when the coaching takes over and then helping to get back on track.
That's really interesting, because when you talk about coaching, one thing that comes to mind is that it does change the dynamic. I mean, as medics, clinicians, we are taught to give advice, to basically know better and to tell people stuff and so on. And here we are, this different mindset that you're bringing in, where actually we are literally empowering people, if you like, holding back ourselves, helping people to take more charge. Feels to me like there's a shift in power going on there, a change in the dynamic. What are your reflections on that? Does it feel like that to you, or what do you think?
Absolutely. It's really interesting to hear you say that, Mark, because that's as I've become more experienced with this, I've become really interested in the power dynamic. And, right. And you know, we may not be aware of it, but we have such a high level of power as a in a leadership position or in a clinician position, don't we? And, you know, we're always the one with the kind of like the title, the name on our door, you know, the expectation. And that creates a really uneven power dynamic. And what I've become more and more aware of is that people's personal perception of their power really influences how well they do, right. How well they think, how well they perform. And actually, it should be a really important part of what we do to try and even up that power dynamic with the people that we're interacting with. Because if people are in a situation where they feel someone else has got a lot of power over them in that relationship, they don't do as well. So that's been a real insight for me, for thinking like this really matters. The way this person performs will be dependent on how powerful they feel in this situation. And my job is to help do everything I can to even up that power dynamic and big up their sense of power in themselves.
That's interesting. So other powerful people are not necessarily empowering, but actually constraining in some ways you describe. It's fascinating.
Well, you can easily do the wrong thing. You know, very, very well-meaning, but the more you try and lead and take control, of course, it's like a seesaw. As your power goes up, their power goes down. So sometimes as a leader or as a clinician, you just have to step back and recognize I've got to drop my power to allow the person I'm working with to rise up and achieve their potential.
That's a very interesting point. I'm just thinking as you're speaking about some of the things that maybe get in the way of us actually doing that, so allowing people, if you like, in inverted commas, to take charge. Maybe what's partly going through my mind is that many of us listening to this have been brought up and trained as therapists, people who are expected to know it all. So you were saying a moment ago with that analogy with the football pitch that the coaches are not necessarily the expert footballers. And yet, to a degree, we certainly, doctors, clinicians, are expected to be experts in the area that we're advising about. How does that fit with the coaching mindset? Does it stand in the way at all, or is it in some way complementary?
Funnily enough, I sort of think it's almost like two sides of a coin, isn't it? You know, there's the illness factor, a bit like when people are injured in that metaphor, where you bring them back from illness back to sort of normality when they're ready to go again. But what we're missing is that kind of taking people who are, if you like, you know, ready to look after themselves and really optimizing how they do it. And I think in healthcare, we very much get stuck in that illness model. You know, there's something wrong with you. We've got to get back to normal. What we're missing is the other side of the coin, which is, look, there's a whole lot you could do here. If we supported you, help you to believe in yourself, help you to generate some skills and some capabilities that you could do that would help you to perform so much better than if we didn't do that with you.
One of the biggies here is how so many people, ourselves included, are pressurized by time. We can feel the victims of time rather than the master of it. And to a degree, we almost forget to appreciate the here and now. I know that's something that's been on your mind and you have done things that have helped you in that regard. Can you share that with us?
Time is a pressure for everybody. Time moves at the same pace for everybody. And actually, you know, no one has more time than anybody else. So if you've got 10 minutes with someone, by the way, I think it really helps to tell people how long you've got so you know you're on the same page. You've only got 10 minutes, no matter how good you are. You know, and actually, you know, what you're trying to decide is how much of that time do I do doing one thing over another? And I think what I've learned as a coach is that, you know, actually, if you decide the best thing to do here is to try and, you know, work to even up the power dynamic, help build up their confidence, to help them connect them with things that make them feel good about themselves, then that's fine. And if you're doing that at the expense of something else, like prescribing a medicine or referring them to somebody, that's okay, because you're professionally judging that's the best use of your time together at that point. I mean, it really helps with shared decision making, doesn't it, to try and decide that together. What is the best use of our time? You can decide that together, can't you? But don't regret the time that you haven't spent, and don't try and rush everything. Don't think, oh, I've got to do that, and I've got to add that, I've got to add that. Just, you know, feel comfortable. I've made a judgment call. We've made a judgment call together on the best use of our time, and that's what we've done. You know, I think if you make peace with time, it relieves a lot of stress and pressure.
You must have learned so much through coaching people with their conditions, with their pain, with their suffering and so on, and helping to improve their lives. I'm guessing that that must have taught you things that have helped you to lead a team or engage in leadership more effectively than you might otherwise have done.
Being a clinician or being a leader, there's a lot of similarities, isn't there? You know, your main focus should be on helping the person you're either leading or working with to think well and to act well for themselves. And it's very much appreciating. It's not really about you. It's not so much about you. Your role is to help that person to get the best out of their situation. So that's a mindset shift. You know, it's not about me finding the solutions or problem solving, whether you're working with someone clinically or whether you're leading a group of people. It's about how do I create the conditions for them to take the lead for themselves. You know, and sometimes that involves you having to step back a bit. And often it does, doesn't it? You know, where actually you have to sort of recognize it's not about you coming up with the answers. It's about allowing somebody the space to do it for themselves.
So let's talk personally, because you must have had difficult situations in which you've learned to do that, if you like, maybe sometimes by doing the wrong thing. We're sort of geared up to give advice to people, maybe with a more facilitative head on. We're geared up to mentor people and so on as well. But neither giving advice nor mentorship are actually coaching people to become themselves. I just wondered from your own life experience how you've learned to do the coaching side of things better and make it more acceptable to people as well.
Learn by mistakes, for sure.
Okay. Join the club.
I've certainly got it wrong a lot of times. You know, and I think that's very well intentioned. And I think people listening to this will appreciate this. So we're all trying our best. You know, most people, nearly everybody in healthcare is trying to improve the lot of other people. That's without doubt. But I think, you know, sometimes you try and rush things, don't you? You know, you think, right, the quickest way for me to get someone better or to get the best out of my team is just to tell them what to do. You know, because I've got really good ideas, I'm really experienced, I've learned a lot, I've studied a lot, I've got some stuff I'll just get across. So I think the first thing for me is being appreciating that isn't actually the best way in the end. You might feel quicker, but actually in the end, it doesn't get you to where you want to get to. So you have to change your mindset, and you have to change your belief that other people have got things to contribute, probably a lot more than you would realize. And if you just give them the space, they will. So that's definitely been a big change I've had to do. And maybe within that, the pace of change as well. You know, you might want things to happen quickly as a leader or as a clinician, but actually sometimes there is just a pace that people have to go at to make that realization and to kind of find their own discoveries and for it to then really bed in and be sustainable for them.
How do you learn the art of just shutting up?
Yes. That's a great one, isn't it? Because it's so crucial, isn't it? And I think that's the skill set. When people say, well, what do I do then? You know, it's less about telling people what to do, but it is learning the art of when to shut up, but then equally when to ask the right sort of questions, when to sort of raise awareness of things you're hearing or reflect stuff back, or, you know, try and unlock blockers for people that might be, you know, inadvertently getting in their way. You know, we often hold beliefs, don't we? You know, someone like me can never do that. You know, I'm not good enough. I just haven't got the experience. I'm, you know, it just doesn't fit my personality. You know, and a good coach is able to reflect that back gently and challenge it a little bit. So it's not to say that you don't challenge, but, you know, it's challenged with the perspective of trying to help that person to perform as well as they can for themselves.
So as well as shutting up, another difficult thing, which I think many organisations struggle with, is, shall we say, allowing people to make mistakes. What are your own experiences with that notion of actually allowing people to experiment? I've used the word mistakes. Maybe that's a word you want to challenge as well. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm gonna, you know, failure, mistakes. It's something we've got to get good at, isn't it? Or something we've got to realize is an important aspect of if we're going to take this style of leadership and this style of approach in healthcare. You have to allow people to make mistakes. I mean, you know, I'm a parent, and you know, there's a very obvious analogy, isn't there, with how you bring up your children. You know, if you always tie the shoelaces for your child, they never learn how to do it. You know, and it takes time, doesn't it? You know, and you have to allow people to make their own mistakes, and almost build that into your system. You know, and the interesting thing I think is that if you do build it in, people probably learn quicker than you give them credit for. And you know, those mistakes are the formative part of developing. If you don't allow those to happen, you won't get good development and you won't get good performance.
Let's just take it to the next level, which is that, you know, part of our, and a very important part of our role as leaders, is to help to shape the culture of our organizations. That's a longer term and tougher thing to do. Let's suppose that actually the coaching mindset that you've been talking about would be a useful part of our culture, not just something for you as a leader to do as an individual, but something that somehow we can all in some way do for each other. First of all, you may want to challenge that idea, but beyond that, what are your thoughts on how we help to develop that cultural shift, attitudinal shift within the organization?
Yeah, I mean, I do very much believe culture is a key part of leadership. And in fact, it's a natural extension from what we've been talking about, because if actually you're deciding it's not your role to tell people what to do and to sort of like give directions and orders, then what are you doing? You know, and I believe good leaders are creating the culture, the sort of framework, if you like, that people sit in. And that, you know, determines how you want people to interact with each other, the sort of relationships you encourage, the sort of freedoms to make mistakes and that sort of thing. I mean, in our PCN, and maybe I can draw on that example, really. One of the cultures that really appeals to me is what's something they call team of teams. It comes from writing from Stan McChrystal, but it's been used a lot, really, around, you know, as a leader, instead of trying to micromanage, control everything in a strict hierarchy, you create teams of people with team leaders and groups of people working together. And as a leader, you trust them to make decisions in their area and to decide how things are going to be done. And what your job as the leader is to do is to kind of make sure all those teams and those team leaders are aligned to an overall sense of purpose and a sense of direction of what you're trying to do. And you just keep really good communication channels going between you. You know, whereas a leader, you know, look, this is what we're trying to achieve. This is, you know, as in our PCN, I keep saying, well, look, there's two real key things to me. One is the level of participation we're generating from people we're working with, you know, self-management, peer support, co-production. And the other is the quality of the work that people feel they're doing. You know, does their work give them meaning? So if I think those are the two things we're aiming for as a network, and I keep communicating that down, then actually what the team leaders are doing is they're appreciating that, and they're then enacting that in their own area. So we have a kind of lead of, you know, the mental health team. So our leader in the mental health team, you know, knows that, and that's what she's trying to do. But then she'll tell me what's going on the ground and what's actually happening and what the realities are and, you know, what the restrictions are and how she's enacting it to the best of her ability. And that, you know, happens in our other three teams. So we have a mental health team, we have a social prescribing stroke community development team, we have a pharmacy team and a medical support team. You know, and we work as these team of teams working together, but I don't control what everybody does. We have this kind of lovely dynamic of interplay between us where we trust and believe in each other.
I know that this genuinely isn't management speak and so on. This is what you are doing. But let's get practical for a moment, because people might think, sounds fantastic, but it could be hopelessly naive. You know, how do we actually do that in practice? Maybe you could say something practically about maybe a couple of the barriers that have made that actually quite difficult to do, and maybe some of the facilitators, some of the things that have helped you just to reinforce this, so actually this becomes embedded. It's gone beyond a great idea that people notionally sign up to something that people start to see the benefit of and starts to have a life of its own.
You know, whatever you do, you need to hold yourself accountable, don't you? So I think as a group, whatever you're doing, you want to try and agree what your end purpose is and how you're going to tell whether or not you're making progress towards that. Right. It's important to have accountability, I'd say. Yeah. I think it's also really important to recognize you don't know all the answers. You know, what I've described there has sort of evolved over the last 3 years. You know, I've read lots of stuff. I've read about team of teams. I've talked to people that I admire. I've read a whole lot of range of other books. But that kind of structure has sort of emerged as we've found the right people, as relationships have blossomed. So in a way, you know, what you set up is a product of your learning as you go along, rather than a necessarily preconceived plan, I would say.
One of the things that we sometimes talk about is how influential people can be as role models. We are very influenced by each other. And I wondered whether you use your own experience of coaching, in other words, how you have learned to develop and grow through the coaching mindset, or notable examples within the team to, if you like, illustrate what it is that's important and what you're talking about and help to reinforce people's motivation to do this.
I think one of the struggles as a leader, and I've struggled with this really, is that you do have ideas. You have this sort of burning desire to achieve something. It matters to you. I think that's what often, as we said at the start, ends up with you ending up in a leadership position, because it's something you really care about. And the danger with that is that you're always, you know, sort of over energetic, and you're sort of like you're squashing people's ability to stretch their own wings and do stuff. So, you know, it does really help when you find people around you who, you know, rise to the challenge. And, you know, I've often found, you know, you give people an opportunity, constantly they surprise you with how good they are. In as a general, I'd say, you know, 10 to 1, you know, you might give someone some leeway and some room, and actually they might make a mistake or not do it as you want. But I'd say that's one out of 10 times. Most of the time, in my experience, you give people some space and some sort of like trust, and 9 out of 10 times they exceed your expectations, and they often surprise you, because you sort of think, wow, you've done stuff I wouldn't even have thought of.
Let's take the opposite, because again, enthusiasts, of which you are certainly one, will see, we are tempted to see the positive side of things, you know, the positive outcomes and so on as they come our way. But there are always people, are there not, who, bless them, will be extremely negative, will pull things down, will say, well, that's a rubbish idea and so on. Unless we're about to eject them from our teams, which we try not to do, how do you deal with that? How do you deal with the naysayers, with the people who will actually, possibly very well-meaningly, point out the error of what they see, your judgment?
Sometimes it's just really annoying, isn't it? And you feel negative.
I'm glad you said that. So isn't it just? They are part of the team, though, aren't they?
Absolutely, and they can feel like a lead balloon. I mean, I think where I've done it best, you know, you have to sort of try and see people as an asset, don't they? You know, the quality of a team is often around the diversity of thinking it brings together. You know, different perspectives, different ethnic backgrounds, different sort of genders, you know, we'll all see things differently. So if you're wise enough to have a team around you that will have different perspectives, and you're capable enough to allow them space, I think that's really functional. I do think there does come a time when, as a leader, you have to sort of say, actually, that influence or that view is really so far from where we're going and having such a negative effect on the rest of the team that you have to be brave and you have to call it out, you know, and I think that does sometimes happen. I have had some experiences of that, and it's not easy to do. It feels uncomfortable, and sometimes you have to accept that there'll be some damage from that, you know, you, because you may not take everybody with you you want to take with you. You just have to accept that's part of it.
Let's just think for a moment about the burning enthusiasm that people may have for their particular project, you know, what it is that drives them and so on. Part of what you've been alluding to quite strongly is that actually other people will have their own ideas and so on, and we have to create space for them to develop that. I've wondered, in practical terms again, how you've managed to, if you like, rein yourself in to give other people their head and allow things to move forward, maybe in directions or using techniques that you personally wouldn't have done. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, and that's a really good question, because hearing you say that, my reflection is probably not as well as I could have done. You know, there's the coaching head, and then there's your actual head that, you know, that you use in the moment. And so I think, you know, personal reflection is really good, you know, and, you know, reassessing that perhaps you could have done it differently in a different way another time, next time. I mean, I think, you know, like I say, it is a balance. You know, you do have to drive things sometimes. And, you know, sometimes when an opportunity opens a door, you have to be the one that say, let's get it done. You know, I remember with the vaccine program in Sheffield, for instance, there was a group of clinical directors, you know, and there was a lot of hesitancy to start off with. You know, can we do this in primary care? Is this, you know, it's too overwhelming. It's too much going on. And I think sometimes you need a few people to say, no, yeah, we can do this. Come on, we can do this. Give people energy and inspire people. So there are moments when that needs to happen. But I think that they're few and far between. And generally, the mainstream should be allowing space for people to contribute and get involved. But there are moments of both, I would say.
The tenor of our conversation has been very positive, but we also know that getting things done takes often, particularly significant things, takes far longer than we might have imagined. And sometimes, you know, it's the reality of leadership is that it's often quite a grind, a lot of energy day after day, just keeping things going. As somebody who has reflected a lot on how to improve your performance and keep things going and keep other people going, how do you deal with the grind, Ollie? You know, because I'm sure you experience it. What helps you to keep going day by day?
I do think it's really important that personally you find things rewarding and they give you energy rather than sap your energy. Otherwise, you're just never going to survive. So it is part, for me, it's part of the game, really, is working out a way of seeing a positive in things. And if you really can't, probably stop doing it or do something different. But you can use your imagination, can't you? I mean, I remember when I was when I was a kid, I think the way I learned this actually was when I moved schools sort of age about 11. And at that time, playing football was my world. You know, it was the thing.
Yeah.
And I was going from a little tiny primary school in a backwaters to a big school in a big city. And I sort of thought, crikey, I'm going to be really out of limb here. And I'm probably going to be one of the worst football players in the team. And it mattered to me. So I spent the whole summer sort of practicing football on my own, but I made up little games, little sort of like, you know, little internal commentaries around, you know, that I was Brian Robson scoring the winning goal in the FA Cup or something. And so I sort of made up little, you know, games to help me enjoy it and to sort of keep myself focused on practicing. And what was interesting is when I got to the school, whether it was the practice over the summer or not, but I ended up being one of the better players, which surprised me, you know, gave me a real lift and confidence. And it sort of reinforced into me that actually, you know, you put a bit of time and effort in, you keep positive about it. Actually, things often work out better than you think. It is really helpful to have a positive internal commentary for yourself.
Right.
You know, people talk, don't they, when people have depression, anxiety, you get this kind of negative internal voice, you know, sort of persecuting you, telling you you can't and you're no good and you're rubbish. And I think I've been lucky enough to sort of cultivate an internal voice that's quite compassionate and, you know, sort of friendly and kind towards me, you know, and actually my gut feeling, even when things are tough, is just to sort of say, well, it's pretty difficult anyway. It probably would have been hard for anybody. And actually, you know, and probably most people would have struggled with that. You gave it a good go. Maybe it wasn't as good as you could have done, but actually, you know, you did all right. And so I try and sort of speak to myself internally in a kind way. And I would say, I think that takes work. It's worth giving that space and time because I think it's a really great asset. I've reflected on that being a really helpful asset to me.
Just from a personal point of view, again, the sort of positive feedback that you get occasionally from people through appraisal or what have you, I just keep a note of that. You're on the computer occasionally. I can just go back to that and remind myself, you know, you're okay, basically. And that just keeps you going.
You don't want to be so self-absorbed that all you're looking for is positive reinforcement all the time. You know,
no.
Again, I guess, underlines a vulnerability in you, doesn't it? You know, you need to be able to be, you know, humble, and you need to be able to take criticism, you know, and take it on the chin, you know, but equally you need to be able to take that in a compassionate way where you say, that's a learning experience for me. And it's really important to hear that. In fact, you know, if you don't culture that if you're not actually trying to create that culture as a leader and those people around you, that it's okay to feedback to me negatively as well as positively, I think you miss a whole lot as a leader.
Ollie, that's been amazing. I just want to end, actually, by thinking about the fact that the majority of our listeners, we think, are going to be fairly inexperienced when it comes to leadership. I just wondered if you could share some tips with us, with them, about taking their first steps in making a difference.
Yeah, well, I mean, hopefully what's come out from this is that leadership is not about knowing what to do, knowing everything about everything and having all the solutions. And I would love to think that we have the leaders of the future that we're trying to develop are the sort of people that are humble and vulnerable, but nevertheless prepared to stick themselves out and give it a go. You know, and actually, if we have people doing that and they're prepared to take the kind of attitudes that we've taken, that sort of coaching style of doing things, that I want to try and create the best conditions for people around me to flourish and do well, it will be a wonderful asset to our system. You know, so if you're out there thinking, well, I'm not really a leader, I don't know enough, and you know, I'm not sure I'm kind of experienced enough to do this, I would say you don't need that. All you need is that mindset that I'm prepared to stick my neck out a bit and try and create conditions for people to do well around me. And if you do that, you will be leading magnificently. You know, you will be a leader. And over time, of course, you'll build experience and you'll get better at it. But it's that first culture and that first kind of like ethos of how you do it that I think makes all the difference.
Fantastic. Ollie, thank you so much for your time. I look forward to meeting up with you again in the near future. But I just want to thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us. Well, that was a real pleasure talking with Ollie. And I think, you know, one thing that comes across very clearly to me, and I hope to you, is just his passion and drive, his great positivity. But, you know, if you're like that, if you like the way Ollie is, it's hard to rein yourself in. And I notice how Ollie has learned that even well-meaning energy and drive can actually inhibit others. There was a passage when he was talking about just the power dynamic, which brought that insight to light. And he talks about how, as a clinician, he wants patients to be better by empowering them and helping them to take control. But he extends that further. And he talks about all of us, you know, as team members. He wants us all to do better. People who want to make a difference for their communities. And he shows us a really powerful way of doing that through coaching people, through giving people opportunities and support to do things in their own way, by building on their own strengths and learning from their experience rather than being, for example, told how to do things, told by their seniors and their leaders and so on how things should be done. And I guess what Ollie's asking us to do, although it's tough, he reminds us that actually we shouldn't forget that we aren't alone in this enterprise. And if we support each other, then we are really part of a team that's worthy of that name. So that's what I take away from this. And it just fills me with positivity and encourages me to recognize my strengths and try and make better use of them and to be more considerate in helping others, feeding back to them what it is that we find remarkable, because there always is something remarkable about what people do and how they can build on that and how we can all learn something from those examples around us. We look forward to welcoming you all in the next of our series, The Leadership Hikers.